relationship means that whether the start frequency is all of the following frequencies that have harmonics simply means to have to be, that have to be multiplied. If you're dealing with the single sine wave, you have no problem with interpreting it. So the guys who goes for the cheap VNA, they have to find a clever way to interpret the information that comes from the square wave. You have a microwave synthesizer, they do not have any DC signal. And you might ask why. So to start the sweep frequency, there is the extrapolation of the DC component. The DC component is what is used to determine impedance. So the lower start frequency, the more accurate impedance measurement, as long as the start frequency is stable. But that doesn't mean that you have a quality of the measurement. And to exchange.
Okay. I don't know where that extends into the question, that the comments that we were making. By the way, square waves are the odd harmonics, some of the infinite series of odd harmonics of that frequency.
That is correct. There was the reason why the technology of the VNA was using or applying this sinusoidal signal, because it was easier to interpret it. So yes, you can have a certain degree of accuracy, and it's much better than the device that we had before. But the question is, if you have to spend $300-$400 for something that is using a square wave, why don't you just try? Just try. You can get it from your friend and try the regular VNA and see what's the result on it and compare it. And to XGA.
Well, Wesley, yes. If people want to, if they have friends who have them, they could borrow them. If not, they could look them up on eBay, and I'm sure there are other sources. Again, the things like nano VNAs are very small, very light, very inexpensive. There's lots and lots of documentation of random quality all over the place. Things like Rig Expert and other companies have well-documented, relatively simple-to-operate controls. You go back to 30, 40-year-old VNAs, you'll get them far less expensively. They'll take up a lot of space. They'll weigh a lot. They'll have a lot of knobs, a lot of dials, and probably a telephone directory of an instruction manual. But again, everyone's free to take their options. I think most modern amateur radio operators are kind of drawn towards the less expensive, simpler design. Yeah, but they're all reasonably good. I have nothing against any of these options.
I think the function of DNA is derived from calculated results, especially the TDR function of it, which creates its own uncertainties on the top of inherent uncertainties of that measurement, of the TDR measurement in general. The biggest point to remember is that after first discontinuity, all of the measurements will be skewed, sometimes to the point where all accuracy can be lost. That's why having something that is just up-down to DC, so it's up DC positive, then it's rapid down to the zero, to the negative part of square wave, to get another DC, and depends what is the duty cycle of it, is just dressed with some kind of 3D functions or additional functions to look nice for your eye. But that has nothing to do with accuracy.
No, it doesn't, but still people like pretty displays, and sometimes it lets people get a better sense for what's going on, as opposed to, you know, looking at, go back to the original question about the antenna analyzers. Were very difficult to really get a nice sense of the totality of an antenna, because you had to get the readings at individual frequencies, and then you had to extrapolate, as opposed to just looking at the curve and saying, ah, it's dipping down there. That's its point of resonance, and the slope in either direction is the cue, and things like that. So it's nice visual cueing. But again, there's nothing bad with your way of doing it either. It's just different strokes for different folks. Extreme accuracy is very important if you're working for the Jet Propulsion Lab. Less so if you got a, you know, $500 shack that you're operating.
Well, look, you have a certain measurement to be done, and you actually use your steps to walk. And you're walking and think, okay, this is more or less 3 feet. So you can take your feet, and how many feet is in this distance? Is it extreme accuracy? No. Is it enough? Depends from your application. Okay, so it's up to you. Whatever satisfies you. You don't want to spend the money? Use a piece of rope to make a measurement. Question is, are you gonna make a 4-incher with it? Are you gonna be sure that you're gonna cut the piece of plywood exactly for your needs? No. You're gonna have a quarter of inch of gap from each side. That's okay. You don't pay for it. So the logic on it is, if you have to spend for good VNA, sort of nano VNA, $400, $500, $600, for that money, you don't have to really do much. Open up your eBay and you can get a traditional one. And the result is right on the money.
Well, once again, the old ones don't hang on your belt. My rig expert does. That adds a great deal of convenience to me. Now, for you, that's not convenient enough to warrant it, I guess. And that last decimal point is very important. To me, I just want to know if my antenna is pretty much working. So I can hook it up to any of my VNAs, from my array solution to my rig expert to even my nano VNA, and I can get a pretty good sensibility of is it resonant, where is it resonant, and how wide is the resonance going to look like. And for me, that's all that I really personally need. Now, it is a 2-port VNA, so people who are into somewhat more esoteric tests that require a 2-port VNA can play around with that. Most hams aren't. Most hams probably are not going to even look into time domain reflectometry. I tend to use it to figure out whether my coaxial cable is damaged in some way, but I'm sure that's not the usual thing that people do. I think 9 times out of 10, if you give an amateur radio operator a VNA, he'll sweep it for resonance, and that's about all he'll do with it. But again, depends on what you want. If you want laboratory calibration, you can buy it used, or if you really want it and money is no object, you can probably buy a smaller, lighter, faster one for a lot of money. The problem is that the people listening tonight, for the most part, are not really, you know, once you get past something like 50, 60, 70 bucks, They already kind of put their hand on their wallet and say, wait a minute, can I get by without it? And, you know, most people can decide often that, yeah, they can do without a VNA. They'll tune their antenna according to their transmitter's SWR meter, and that's all that they really need. Again, I think it loses something by not trying out inexpensive VNA, but people will differ.
You're right. Yes, I agree with you. Absolutely. I have a lot of photographic equipment that use batteries, and those batteries are expensive. $60, $200 for the camera. And I've noticed that when I drop the battery, sometimes the battery is not. I open up the battery and I see that one of the leads of those cells inside, they actually are not counting any longer. This is usually very hard to solder, or it's not solderable, but could be welded. So I was on the auction, I saw for $150, a little bit more than that. A spot welder, very nice, that was like $15,000, but on the auction was for $150. I put it just because in case in addition to the 12 batteries that I have dead right now, I have another 12 batteries dead. At the tips of these are about $1 each, because different for carbon, different for color and whatsoever. And the good point that you have is when you buy a VNA, you don't need much more. You have the cheap device, have a cheap open short and 50 ohm make it pretty much exact for the device, and you don't need more. The bad thing is that when you buy a real stuff, then you really expect from this real stuff the real work, and anything you touch there, it's money. So I happen to order the two sets of tips for welding, and it's already for $100. And then I cut myself for this money, in addition to the money that I spent for the device and shipping of the device, that is bulky and big, I could actually buy new batteries. So you're absolutely right. Buy cheap, use cheap, eat cheap. And to Exia.
Well, you know, ultimately you have to do a cost analysis on things, unless you just want to run on emotion. A lot of times, unfortunately, if you take a look at some interesting stories of what people have done, financially doesn't quite make that much sense. I've used this example before, so I beg forgiveness of people who are hearing this way too many times. QSC had an article on a guy who wanted to a power shortage proof his house. He had a couple of outages a year or so. So he took his entire garage, emptied it, and filled it with lead acid cells and some other electronics. And when the guy who interviewed him kind of asked how much all this costs and how long it will last before he has to replace it, it sounded very much like you could afford to take the same money and just use it for a nice hotel room in an area that didn't have a power outage. Sometimes people over-engineer things and over-purchase things. Sometimes they want to. Sometimes it sneaks up on them. So you got to kind of come to a conclusion of things that are worth it to you. Now, I had sort of the same problem. I had a battery that needed replacement, that needed to be spot welded. That's what you were describing. Some batteries are not soldered together, but they're spot welded with a metal tab, and the metal tab itself is soldered. So if the metal tab falls off, you can't really resolder it. You need to spot weld it. This particular device cost me approximately $3. So I threw it in the garbage and bought a new one. Now, would I like a spot welder if I had the time and the money and the place to put it and all kinds of things? Yeah, that would be neat. Could I make any sense of that economically? Not whatsoever. At least you have the expensive camera batteries. I just had a relatively inexpensive device that happened to have a metal tab battery. But I understand. And sometimes we go a little bit off the end and spend a lot of money to have equipment that we really are not going to get much use out of. Some people have a lot of equipment, not many, but most people have no equipment. I'm still amazed at the occasional amateur who doesn't even have a voltometer.
Yes, I mean, again, you're right. Again, you're right. When was the last time that you sounded something that had the label made in America? Everything is cheap, and everything is from China. You buy the coffee maker, three times used, throw it to the garbage, buy another one. That's how they make money. That's how they become a great country. For all of those guys who work for few dollars per day, and in that communist version, because you want to spend for junk, use the junk, throw it to the garbage, and buy another junk. But when the people buy the car, they expect from the car to be everything excellent. The most they can get for the money, and the best is when they pay for something, is if they pay very little and get the best. But when they selling something, they can only see how much is worth at the present time. So mostly people throw it to the garbage. And that's how American money goes to the garbage. You want to have a garbage stuff, garbage junk in your house? That's your choice, Dr. Roy, not me. So, yes, I'm doing an extremely big mistake. I'm buying expensive equipment for cheap money, but then all of the addition to it cost me tremendous amount of money. So yes, you're right. If you don't want to become a 4-inch maker, don't buy the expensive machine. The best of it is pay for the labor. Somebody's gonna come to you, do it your job, charge $350 per day or sometimes per hour, depends, or change your luck. Don't repair your luck. No. Call for locksmith. He's gonna be an hour. He's gonna do an excellent job with Chinese cheap luck on it, and he's gonna charge you $350 for the labor. So if this is how the future is gonna go, this is how your projection is. And to extreme.
Well, again, I don't want to fall into the philosophy net. It's not an apples and oranges. It's not a 0-1. It's not a binary choice. You don't go cheap for everything. I hope not. Some people, I guess, go cheap for everything, and some people go the most expensive, just suppose the fact that it's the most expensive. My coffee machine is an espresso machine that was made in Italy, not China. But I can understand why people want an inexpensive coffee machine, and that's one of the major places that has cheap labor that makes cheap equipment. And so, again, unfortunately, the American public is a very kind of disposable mindset. They don't want particularly to pay for longevity. They get tired of things. They want an excuse to buy a shiny new one. I don't feel that way for most things. When technology warrants it, yeah, sure. But otherwise, again, I like my cappuccino. I like my espresso, and I'm willing to pay for it. So I don't buy a Chinese espresso machine.
Thank you for that, Dr. Roy. That was a great comment. You like your Italian machine. It has nothing to do with Chinese. I like 34 years old American-made equipment or Swiss equipment. I have two electron microscopes, exactly the same model. And the one was made in Swiss, and the other one was made in France, but based on the Swiss license. Could I buy something that is cheap and Chinese? Of course I could. Why I don't? I'm not rich enough to lose my money on junk. But thank you very much. You're right. And to exchange.
And then there are guys someplace in the middle who fascinate me endlessly. They will buy a piece of Chinese equipment. A couple of YouTubes I saw, laser engravers. And they will basically rebuild them. They will take out bits and pieces of them and ruggedize them and make them higher quality than they were manufactured to. So there is that actual middle ground someplace for some people who are willing to put in their own labor and expertise and such.
Thank you very much. I have nothing to add.
Okie doke. Well, thanks for the participation. Anyone else out there with questions of a technical nature, science, medicine, what have you? This is AC2GS with the Limark Technical Net. Just hit that push-to-talk button, give me your first name and your call sign.
KD2VHD with a comment for Wesley.
Yes, Jim.
Wesley, I don't want to be rude. I don't mean to be rude at all. But you're right. But most of us out here are looking at the forest and the trees, and you're talking about the chemical makeup of the sap. So recognize your audience, because we're all different. Many of us are noobs, and Roy's very tolerant of you going on and on, but we don't know what you're talking about mostly. And I'd like to buy American equipment, but I'm pissed off that most of it doesn't do what I want it to do, and I got to buy Chinese stuff to make it do what I want it to do. I'm not happy about it, and I'm trying to change it. But we can't spend hours and hours and hours on one little teeny tiny topic and keep the crowd listening. So I don't mean to be rude. It sounds rude, but that's my thought. KD2BHD, Jim, I'll be listening.
Yeah, I agree with you. I should not take that much time to talk about it. I assume that there was no other people who were willing to comment on it, and that time wouldn't be used anyhow, but maybe that was a wrong assumption. Thank you for your comment.
Thank you for your response.
Okay, very good. Jim, just out of curiosity, and if you don't want to expand on it, I could understand. What particular American manufacturer's product do you feel is more limited than the Chinese products available?
It's hard to explain exactly, but for example, I just bought a radio. It's sold by Radiodity, or Radiodity, however they say that. It's a DB20G. It's actually a GMRS radio, but it's similar to an Anytone 779, and there's another company that sells a similar version. It's tiny, it's small, it does, you can do dual bands on various versions of them, and it's $100, and it does everything it needs to do, and it's very versatile. And there's nothing comparable from Japan or America that I can figure out. And I don't know why. I'm very dissatisfied with American products, that we should be leading this field, and we drag our feet behind. I'm new to this realm, but I've been driving cars and using tools a long time, and I'm not happy. We need to raise our own bar.
Okay, I understand your feelings. I think the problem, unfortunately, is that most small industry is sort of gone from the United States. They sort of gave up. They decided that competing with third world countries' labor for manufacture is not doable, and so they've kind of moved away from small items into large industrial and large consumer manufacturing, and gone as far away from small units as humanly possible. You even have the iPhone, the very popular cell phone line, that's manufactured in China because that they feel that they have to bring down the labor cost. So the United States, unfortunately, does not manufacture a lot of small goods. They may put a label on it, and the label will say assembled in the United States, but for all intents and purposes, manufacturing of anything other than large items is kind of a thing of the past in the United States. The United States sort of shifted to both agricultural, heavy industry, and service industries. And for the foreseeable future, unless the bottom falls out of the cheap semi-slave labor market of third worlds, I don't know how you can bring that back.
Certainly a problem, but I think that most of us are less in the market for cheap and more in the market for value. If you gave me a better product at a price that wasn't crazy, I'd be well willing to pay more. Show me the product. So we're going philosophical. If you want to go back technical, that's okay. Thank you for hearing my thought, Wesley and Doc. I segued you a bit. Sorry.
We can stick our big toe in the philosophy net. We just shouldn't spend the evening on it. So I thank you for your participation and your feelings. I mean, I think we all kind of share them to a degree, but we're all somewhat guilty of keeping this ball rolling. We're consumers. We vote with our dollars. We vote with our buying from Amazon instead of retail brick and mortar stores, and all kinds of things that kind of have a detrimental effect to the culture that we were brought up in. So I thank you for that, Jim. Once again, I am AC2GS. My name is Roy, and this is the Limark Technical Net. So if you have any questions of a technical nature, or science-related, or medicine-related, please hit that push-to-talk button, give me your first name and your call sign.
Yes, there is nobody, but we could talk for a moment about technological drifting and technological perspective and to achieve.
Okay, we could give it a try.
We may assume that people such like me, who weren't born in the rich family, and there was always something that we didn't have, or most of things that we wanted to have we didn't have, wanted to have something. And that something was piece of American beauty. So then I found that it is not only me, but most of the people from Eastern Europe, they really are amazed with everything what America is about. But it was 70s, 80s, and 90s. Then I wanted really to touch it. I was buying houses here, so at the time I said to myself, why should I pay for anything that requires any kind of wood job? How about if I make I buy myself the wood shop? So I was buying all of those machines possible, and then find out that there is no end to it and I don't need it longer. So 2 years later, I just sold everything because I bought it cheap. Then I sold it for more than I paid for it. But then I asked myself, why is that happening? I could not understand. Why is that happening? Why is it that nobody's buying anything? The new American machine is not being sold, and right now the old one is the only American, and people still prefer to have American, and they for that junk more than I paid for it. Then 2 years passed by, and I decided that I want to have a mechanical shop. So lathes, mills, CNC machines, shapers, all kind of stuff, and then I find out that it's never ending story. You all need to, you need for all of this special tools and test equipment and demand. And then I started to my own lab, so I decided that I want to have a winder. And then I looked at the Chinese junk, and there were winders, plenty of winders for Benny. And then I look at the American stuff, and I ask myself, why is that this old, 40 years old stuff costing that much money? It's more expensive than the Chinese one. Okay. And a few times I was trying to buy something, but I wasn't fast enough. Somebody bought it before me. And then I find out that there's nothing that is being made in America. And then I ask myself a question, why is that? Well, why is that? Because Chinese make it cheaper, more shiny, they have excellent shipping rates, and they are right on the money for most of the people who dream to have something. And then there was a problem of quality. So, what we are drifting to? No, we are not drifting to anything that is of value. We are drifting something that is a complete disaster. We have a plumbers and electricians here, and the rest of it is in China. And Chinese children are in American universities. They're occupying 70% of the places. So my question to you, Dr. Roy, and to others is, where is the technology, American technology, drifting? We are the masters of most of the technologies. Our manufacturers are in China. But they have one condition. You can be in China only if you give up rights to your technology to Chinese, and then you can make a money. And to exchange.
AC2GS. Well, yeah, this is a real complicated subject. You know, it's not like American technology was kind of born here. It kind of was imported here. If you take a look at a lot of United States citizens that have won Nobel prizes, a good percentage of them were immigrants. And a lot of foreign students in the science programs attend, a significant portion continue stay here in this country, get jobs in research, get jobs in those colleges. So we've been kind of sucking the brains of the outside world as well. China kind of skips a few steps and just steals it, which some companies are finally becoming aware of. Some still aren't. Good old Elon Musk, at a recent interview, I think, made some comment that he doesn't mind if the Chinese steal all of his technology because he wants to share it with the world. I'm not quite sure what's going on in that guy's mind most of the time. But that's the nature of things. Everyone's trying to kind of draw out expertise from other people. So far, the United States is still very powerful in research development and technology. I think they're going to progress. I don't think we've stopped learning stuff. I think there's still a lot of things, material science and otherwise, that a lot of colleges and companies in the United States are going to continue to work at and figure things out. It's always going to be a battle against nation states and such, China has cheap labor. It has large populations, but they sort of tend to lack originality. They are not the greatest programmers in the world, far, far from it. And a lot of research, kind of, they can dot the I's and cross the T's, but they don't seem to be good at starting up on projects. So I still think the Western world is ahead of them on that. I think the United States is still ahead of them. I think, unfortunately, we've gone into a codependency with China. They manufacture our inexpensive goods and moderately expensive goods, sometimes very expensive goods. And I don't know a simple solution to that.
George, KD2FIU.
Yes, George.
Okay, Roy, I would disagree with the first half of what you said. And that is, people
didn't come here with that knowledge. They came here with the ability to absorb the knowledge with the momentum of technology that was being developed here. I don't think that they came here from other countries 50, 60 years ago, 40 years ago, 30 years ago, 20 years ago. They didn't come here with that technology to absolutely interject into our development over here. They came in and they started or became part of companies that already existed. They didn't come here with those patents and that knowledge. Back to you, Roy.
Well, it sort of depends on who you're selecting for that as an example. I would give you Wernher von Braun. I don't think he learned rocketry in the United States. I think we basically packaged him, and shipped him over to the United States to make our rocket industry better than the Russians, who had bought Bach and delivered to themselves a couple of other German World War II rocket engineers and such. So there's a little bit of trading people who already have expertise and knowledge. But you require talent. I mean, okay, a person with a native talent to playing the piano when they're 5 years old can't play the piano that well, and they need an education to learn how to play the piano that well. But if you take Joe Schmo and you give them the same education as these people who are pretty much prodigies, you're not going to get much in the way of a piano player. So to a degree, we gave them the education. A lot of their professors, by the way, were foreign-born as well. So, you know, it gets a little bit slippery and gray around the edges, as far as I can see.
Oh, so you're agreeing with me.
I wouldn't exactly call it agreeing with you, because again, I'm not saying that we're stealing knowledge from Europeans. I'm saying that we are enticing talented, intelligent students to the United States, training them in our schools, which are often have professors who came from those foreign countries, and hope that a good percentage of them will take up positions in the United States and add to our font of knowledge. I don't quite think that's exactly what you were saying.
I don't think you understood what I was saying. We're not stealing technology. I was referring to the opposite. A lot of technology has been developed here that was stolen from us. We're not stealing technology from Europeans. People have come here with talent. Let me put it this way. If you work for a company that says to you, I don't want you to sell any patents from what we have been developing here, from anything that you've learned here over the years, and if you work for that company 10, 15, 20, 30 years, whatever, and you come up with something, who did you work with? You worked with the people around you. You worked with the technology within the company that was around you. You worked with the entire environment of what was going on and the progress going on in this country. And if this company says, if you invent something and you want to sell that and it's different from what we do, they should own it.
Unfortunately, it's vaguer than that. The Chinese have been well known for co-opting intellectual property. I don't think they give a damn about that. They kind of skirt all the intellectual property rules. And as I think you mentioned earlier, it is common practice among the Chinese. They entice large companies with the fact that they have such a population, such a large economy, that, you know, they kind of tell them that they could make billions off of it, But they need to hire a bunch of Chinese people to get into the patents and information. And a few years down the road, there's a company set up by the usually Chinese Communist Party, some friends, that basically robs them of their intellectual property, and then they get thrown out of the country. And eventually, I think companies are going to figure this out. It's going to take them way too much time, but I think they'll figure it out eventually and try and figure out a way around this. This is very problematic. If you have a country that violates IP and is big enough to tell you to walk away, there's not a lot that you can do. You can't really bomb countries anymore. It's frowned upon.
KD2FYU, Roy, this had been established 100 years ago in the 1920s in this country. If you're working with somebody and they're providing you with education, you're providing them with education, they're providing you with an entire affiliation of people that are providing you with education, that is theirs and it should be patented. If you sell it, you should be penalized. You should be stopped from doing it. There is nothing wrong with saying what's ours is ours. KD2FYU.
Okay, but what happens if a country outside of the domain of the United States finds out the secrets, the trade secrets, and applies them, both nationally and then exports it? What do you do? You penalize them in some way that they can live with and continue to do it? Or do you threaten to bomb them? Or what exactly do you do?
KT2VHD.
Yes, Jim.
Quick comments. You just send them home. It's that simple. And second comment is, Wesley, well said. I very much appreciate your sentiments. Nicely done. Couldn't agree more. KD2VHD listening.
Okay, very good. I'm not quite sure about sending them home. I mean, unfortunately, it's sort of the opposite that's going on. A lot of big companies with a lot of IP are over there trying to make billions of dollars, kissing up to them, doing all kinds of things, and they're getting robbed every which way. So probably, ultimately, they're going to have to come home here.
It depends on who gets the satellites up in the air to find out where the rare elements are. China is doing that right now. They are circulating multiple satellites to actually observe where in the Earth the rare elements needed for future planning of development is needed. They're not just looking for places to live. They're not looking for places to grow things. They're looking for places to find elements, rare elements within the Earth via satellites and different technology. KD2FIU, and I'll back off.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
I actually had a question, so I don't know if you want to continue with this.
Well, I mean, I'll just kind of put my cap on it as best that I can. I am sure that the Chinese are spending a lot of time and effort in finding and mining rare earth elements. It's incredibly important. We're going to run out of lithium the way we're building batteries for cars and such. So there's that, there's indium, there's about 20, 30 different compounds and elements that are very rare but are important to the modern technological world. I would imagine that the United States and Europe and all kinds of different countries are doing that simultaneously. And in addition, there is a lot of diplomatic nonsense going on with the Chinese in Africa to get the rights for a lot of Africa's mineral rights. So, I would tend to agree that they're looking and they're planning to buy it or take it or something. But I think the rest of the world is kind of in the same situation. But, Paul, what's your question?
Okay, I was taking a speaker apart the other day, you know, disconnecting things. You know, the speaker wire, you know, all speaker wire that I've come across is always two different metals, you know, one's copper and the other one's silver. And I know I used to notice that one time, but for the life of me, I can't remember it. So I tried Googling it. Why in the world do they have two different metals in speaker wire? You remember, Roy? Back to you.
I always kind of thought that that was their weird way of offering you a simple case of the polarity. Whether it would cause the cone to go in or out. I don't exactly remember what it's there to tell you, but I think historically that was the point.
Yeah, I searched the internet. You know, Googled it. You know, Google's your friend, but I don't remember. Is there some cases where you do need to have polarity on that? Maybe the older systems?
I don't know. That kind of predates me probably. But I assume there was. Maybe there were electrolytic capacitors and such that were used to modify the sound quality and frequency range of a given speaker system.
VDH for comment.
Yes, John.
I think they do provide phasing information if you're going to hook up a number of speakers together. I remember that old project from Pop Electronics years and years ago called the Tweet 16, where they took 16 speakers and they hooked them up in series and parallel to keep the same impedance. But they had to be phased right to get the full effect. So you wanted all the cones moving forward, you know, on the positive half of the cycle. So that might be an indication for phasing of the speakers to have multiple units.
So. Okay, that's a great reason, because you really don't want one cone going in an enclosure while the other one goes out. You'll kind of suck it back inside and it will have, negative interference with it. So, yeah, that sounds good.
VHG with a clarification.
Yes, Jim.
Equally important that the left and right channels or, you know, any number of channels in a multi-channel system, that the cones are moving in the same direction. Because if they're moving in opposite directions, you're going to have a noise-canceling system rather than a noise-adding system.
Yeah, I agree entirely. Most speakers that I can thumb through in my brain have a plus and minus sign along with the speaker connections on the receivers. So yeah, it's theoretically possible to miswire the left and the right and to have a distorted sound environment. Yes, Wesley.
There's not only that. If you connect two 8-ohm speakers in parallel, you have a 4-ohm. If you connect another speaker in parallel, then the impedance, actually, they're talking about the resistance, but the impedance is even much smaller. So if you in the early evolution of those cables, it was difficult to have a cable with different colors. And it was technologically different. So they come up with the conclusion that if we make a coating on a wire different, then it would never be missed, even if years later that insulation changed the color, is no more recognized left from right. But then they find out that with that, it comes also a great saving of the money, so they can still sell the wires and still make money on it. And the client would not really see much of a discomfort on it. Let me drop it. So, there was a copper with coated with zinc, or even sometimes they put any kind of plated interconnections, not only the wires by itself. Trying to recall right now what was the metal that was more, most likely used in 70s and then 80s. I believe that was steel and zinc. So they find out, okay, steel is not so good, it's very resistive, but if we coat it with zinc, it would be able to carry reasonably clean signal. But the clean signal was clean signal based on what you hear. But then nobody asked itself too much of the questions, why is that clean signal? Well, it's not much loss of the resistance of the wire. So if you had 8 ohm speakers and then you add up 20 ohms of the wire, then it's not going to work good. So what they did is they invented the transformer. In some of the PA systems, you had a transformer that were giving you 60 volts, or I mean giving you, you would have a voltage level, 60 volts or even higher on it, and even if you had the losses, it would still be good for the system. Especially when they were not using tubes at that time any longer, or not any longer yet. They were using magnetic amplifiers. The magnetic amplifiers were nothing but very much clever transformers. Back to you.
And WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
I like the cone. The cones going at the same time idea. That's the best. That really makes sense. Thanks, guys. Back to you, Roy.
Yeah, that makes the most sense to me as well. You want your arrays in phase, and the easiest, cleanest way of doing it is color coding the actual wires that are visible when you're doing the final wire up of any kind of speaker array in a case. Impedances are going to be the same. It depends upon if you're connecting them parallel or series or what have you, but if you swap the phases, the impedance is going to remain the same. So it's a phase-related situation, which makes sense. Okay, I think we did that one. Again, this is AC2GS with the Limemark Technical Net. If anyone has any further questions of a technical nature, science, medicine, what have you, feel free, hit that push-to-talk button, give me your first name and your call sign.
I have another one, if you want to take it. This is WS2N.
Sure, Paul.
The other night on the, I think it was the nostalgia that we're talking about tubes, and you know, some of the tubes have a connection at the top of the tube. You know, you might have 6 or 7 connections or 8 connections on the bottom of the tube. But now you have this one connection that goes to the top of the tube. Do you remember what that is for? Yeah, George was talking about this the other night. Back to you.
You talking about a plane cap?
Yeah, I agree with that. You're talking about the anode or the plate.
Yeah, Roy, but all the tubes don't have that, you know. You know, some of them will have all these connections on the bottom. You know, why'd they put that one on the top? Why didn't they just put that one on the bottom?
It was at 3,000 volts.
Really? Okay, back to you, Roy.
VDH with a comment?
Yes, John.
Actually, I have seen some receiving tubes, you know, low power receiving tubes, where they bring out a grid connection as a cap. A7, I think, is one that comes to mind. Anyway, but I have seen receiving tubes that come out with a grid connection as a cap.
Possibly isolation to avoid feedback.
Yeah, that sounds reasonable. Yeah, that sounds like a good reason.
and those grids were like 450, 450 volts, not 3,000.
A few days ago, and we were talking about vacuum tubes, and he knows a great deal about vacuum tubes, but he was concerned that, you know, if he presented something along those lines here, people would be not interested. I think vacuum tubes are a fascinating subject. Almost all of us grew up with vacuum tubes, even if we may not have that many in our homes anymore.
Comment?
Yes, please.
687 has a grid connection on the top. It's a pentagrid converter.
Okay, very good. And do you know the reason behind that? Is it isolation from feedback and such?
K2GJE. I have the tube manual right in front of me. I think they have a seven pin socket. They ran out of places to make a connection, so they brought out let's see which grid. They brought out the second grid. The first grid is on pin 5. 1 and 7 are the heaters. 2 is the plate. 3 is a suppressor grid. It's quite a complicated tube. They ran out of connections, so they put one of the grids up on top over.
Oh, okay, that's another good reason. I'm just curious, again, my experience with vacuum tubes basically are just television sets when I was growing up and radio sets and such. Were there any tubes that had multiple top connections?
DDH?
Yes, John.
Yes, there were a number of tubes that did have double connections. Let's see, E1148 is when it comes to mind. I remember it because it was a surplus tube, and it did have a double pin connection, a double cap connection. I don't know if it was a dual triode or something, but I think both both grid pins or both plate pins came out as a dual connection. There were some other tubes by CBS Hytron that did have a double pin connection. And of course, there are a lot of transmitting tubes, I think, that have a plate and a grid cap because the voltages are so high.
That was actually dual triodes or dual tetrodes or dual pentodes. So you mostly had the two anodes on the top and the rest of it at the bottom. And that was because sometimes the electrons from the cathode to anode had the tendency to actually circulate down, and that was a similar action to cyclotron. And so they wanted to prevent it as a bad influence on the tube.
Okay, that's fascinating. That's interesting. There's a lot of stuff on vacuum tubes. I think I recently bought a Radio Society of Great Britain published a book on vacuum tube technology, you know, thermionic devices and such. I understand there were receiver vacuum tubes that had basically three vacuum tubes encased in one glass covering.
Yeah, I came across that one, WB2EAV.
Yeah.
That might be the compactron AFC.
What people were able to do with vacuum tube technology before quantum mechanics gave us solid state physics and the transistor and all its permutations. And now most of the stuff we have tends to be semiconductor based. There's still a lot of people out there who have linear amplifiers that run on vacuum tubes. Some audio fans still have either preamps or amplifiers that have a vacuum tube stage because they like what they call the warmth of the vacuum tube in the circuit. It's a fascinating subject, and I think one of these days we should figure out some way of doing some kind of exposition on the concept of vacuum tubes. I think it would be fascinating.
Real radios glow in the dark.
Plus, they're very good for this time of the year. They warm up the shacks.